Good morning. Pray tell, is this, you might ask? Well, COVID can't always lead. Even if yesterday brought the sneaky, nasty news confirming our worst fears. The devil's restrictions extending into April. But why the pop? Well, a Turkish clinic measured heart rate and blood pressure and found that 96% of people relaxed when listening to 80s pop. All of which was a shameless excuse for DJ Simon Marr and Team Drive Time to shuffle onto the dance floor.
People talk about how you put songs together and that there's a, you know, there's a key to writing these songs and a formula or whatever it is. But sometimes the songs, they just are. There's something about them. There's a wow factor. And a lot of the time, even when the songs have been written, and I remember watching a documentary and it was talking about some of the biggest hits of the 1980s, and a lot of the people who wrote the songs had no idea what it was that was going to work. But when it worked, it was that imperceptible, just that thing that just worked for people. And even now, no matter what else is going on, you hear the song and you go, yeah, this is it. Now I feel better.
Ever the contrarian, though, here's Cormac.
What's great about the songs is that there is something about them. There's something timeless about them, but there's also just something that it, that manages to grasp a mood. You know,
hang
when you
on a second here now. Hang on a second.
You know you're going to do well.
When a conversation goes too much to one way, it kind of makes me feel queasy. Because I remember having conversations about 80s music with people who know far more about music than me. And they said it was like the fashion in the 80s and the movies in the 80s. It was rubbish.
Come
we
on,
all remember
Cormac.
The black shoes
Come
and the white
on.
Socks and the, the shoulder pads and the big hair. I mean,
actually wearing shoulder pads today. And I also
strike
have big
that
hair.
The record.
I've spent a lifetime working as an indie music DJ with very credible indie music records, but still, there is still something about it. And as I say, sometimes they do great surveys to work out what it is and how it is and why these songs are still great. But sometimes it is just that thing. If they look, it just works. It's just great. And they just are good when somebody hears the opening bars of A-ha's Take On Me, or, you know, a Frankie Goes to Hollywood comes on. Mm-hmm. It's there. It's something that's there straight away. And no matter how cool or credible or unfashionable or whatever something is, if it's good, it's good.
Simon Marr with Sarah and Cormac. And Sports' Greg Allen spoke to Porrick Harrington, who's in quarantine after testing positive for COVID-19. He's 8 days into it.
There was different emotions. I did 2 days solid of Netflix and just, you know, binged on that. And then I really got bored of that. And then the next day, it was funny, somebody sent me a WhatsApp of some 80s nostalgia. And it just set off a wave. And I nearly did 24 hours of 80s pop music and 80s TV sitcoms and all sorts of things like that, which really cheered me up, actually, at that stage.
Proof positive that the bangles cure all ills. And now to the COVID. Because while yesterday's news on the restrictions extending wasn't exactly a bombshell, it was the lackadaisical manner in which the news was communicated that was at issue. Here's Brian Dobson on yesterday's News at One with the Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar.
The way this has been communicated to the public by way of interviews, and good luck to any journalist who can get information out of the Taoiseach or any minister, but through media interviews, through leaks from parliamentary party meetings. Let me put to you what the Irish Council for Civil Liberties has been saying. They say it's deeply dysfunctional and incredibly disrespectful, the leaking of a further 9 weeks of restrictions. Now, we can quibble over whether it's nine or four, five or whatever the figure is, but to be communicating this information in this way with the public, is that at all acceptable?
Yeah, but in fairness, that isn't what happened. You know, I saw the clip from the Taoiseach's interview last night, and what he said was that we're facing into tough restrictions into April, and I don't think anyone's surprised at that. He didn't say that we're going to be in level five till May, or that we were facing 9 more weeks of a level five lockdown. So, you know, in fairness to him, I don't think that's what he actually said. But like I say, we have the advice from NPHET now. We're on the right track. We can open schools, childcare, ECHE on a phased basis throughout March and through to the Easter break. We can ramp up the vaccine programme. We're going to do that. Our hospitals are going to be relieved of pressure, and we're going to restore some normal healthcare. And so that's all good things happening across the course of March. And we will review the situation then again after Easter.
Yesterday's news at one. The community rollout of the vaccination plan started this week, with the over 85s gleefully rolling up their sleeves. Cormac spoke to Dr. Niall McNamara from the Keogh practice in Waterford, who described the atmosphere in the clinic.
It's been fantastic. I mean, the buzz around the place has been electric. I mean, for everyone, for the patients, for the staff, for, you know, for everyone involved. And it's obviously a relief to get going and get started. They're such a fantastic group, you know, the over 85s. And remember, these are all 85s, many of whom are living independently in the community. And they're an inspiring group of people at the best of times. And when they come in, and just the sheer positivity, you know, there want to be something very wrong with them not to get a lift from it today. It was fantastic.
How many over 85s do you have in your clinic, doctor?
We have just over 360, and we hope to get we will get 300 done today, and we'll do another 72 tomorrow. So we're just really looking forward to getting this group, you know, the first dose, and getting them on their way to hopefully getting the protection that they need.
And that feeling of almost giddy relief was echoed when Brian O'Connell visited Elmwood Medical Practice in Cork. He spoke to vaccine recipients Cathy, who was with her husband Tim, and they're both in their 90s.
Good morning, we're very good, thank God. Looking forward to getting our jab, 96 and 94.
Fair play to you. So this is a day you've been waiting long for.
Indeed, then, yes, indeed.
How has it been for you the last few months?
You get worried now and again, you know. So, looking forward to this now, so it gives us a new lease of life.
Will it change?
However long more we have.
Ah, well, you're fighting fit by the looks of it to me. Will it change your lives much, do you think?
Well, I think it will, yes, yes. We'll have something to look forward to. That'll give us a little bit longer here, anyhow.
How do you feel, Cathy? You've just got your vaccine.
Feel very well.
Relieved?
Yes, oh yeah, very much so. A little bit longer here on Earth anyhow.
So it's a relief for you now. At least you know you have a bit of peace of mind after
exactly.
today.
Exactly, yeah. Yes. Good night. I said to Robert, we're here that long, you'll have to get the gun out.
Surely not. And Brian spoke to their son, Robert, who was understandably emotional given the day that was in it.
The isolation, especially in the first lockdown, was quite difficult for them. They have home care help at 94 and 96. That's understandable, I suppose, that they would. But the HSE care plan was very supportive, and with a phone call, it was gone. So that was two carers a day, Monday to Friday, and one at the weekends.
Really tough. So
and then my mum at 95. My dad has slight dementia. So at 95, my mum was caring for herself and my dad.
Really tough.
My kids couldn't go near the house in their teens and 20s. We were very restricted in what we could do for them.
So how do you feel today, seeing your mum and dad walk down the corridor?
Oh, it's emotional.
It is emotional, isn't it?
It's a big relief. So we keep up our vigilance for the next 2 weeks. And
it's really tough.
Yeah. Especially at their age, you know? They're in their 90s, and they're quite frail, but tough, you know, tough at all.
They're of that generation.
Robert with Brian O'Connell in Cork. On Wednesday, a plan was finally unfurled for the Leaving Cert class of 2021. Haven't they been through the mill? They can opt for accredited grades, the new term calculated be gone, or sit the exam, or both. Now, the ASTI and the TUI have expressed reservations about this hybrid model, and they're going to be consulting their members. So this may not be over, but the students, they're taking the win. Morning Ireland's Killian Sherlock spoke to Beth Doherty from the Irish Second Level Students' Union.
I think it's a massive relief. I think just to know what's happening and to know what we're working towards and to know that we have that level of choice on a subject-by-subject basis. I think the biggest thing is we've been asking for clarity and choice this whole time. and it delivers that. And I think going forward now, we need to work on ensuring there's compassion and that this is delivered properly and bringing students along the way. But as of right now, I'm extremely happy and extremely relieved.
At least someone's happy. Back in a bit. Welcome back. There was a thoughtful thread running through much of the radio this week. Moments of wisdom that were very welcome as we struggle to find meaning in the mundane and this extraordinary time through which we're living. On Sunday, Brendan spoke to Irish philosopher Richard Carney. His new book, Touch, Recovering Our Most Vital Sense, explores that most human and instinctual of needs, the one to reach out and hold another's hand, to hug, to comfort, to heal. And we got ourselves a schooling in why the eye had come to triumph over touch.
We trust our audience after 12 on a Sunday that their minds are open to a little bit of philosophy. So to explain to me about Plato and Aristotle and about how sight became the important sense.
Yeah, OK. Well, you know, as everybody probably does know, Plato and Aristotle go back to the very beginning of Western thought and Western civilization. And Plato basically argued that man, Greek anthropos, means the one who stands up, the one who reaches up and looks towards the skies. In other words, the movement away from the quadrupeds and our interspecies sort of belonging with the natural world towards our specific intelligence as human beings, as Homo sapiens, for Plato was linked with sight, because sight could keep things at a distance. Whereas touch, he said, brought us too close to things. You could see without being seen. You can stand back and look at something, you know, 100 yards away, a mile away, with telescopes thousands of miles away. But when you touch, you're tangible. And this double sensation, you know, as the Greeks realized, exposed us to others. And for Plato, this was too risky. So Platonic love for Plato, we even use the term, is keeping people at a distance. Whereas giving us control of the environment. So the eye rules supreme. Whereas Aristotle actually said something different, although he lost the debate to Plato ultimately, which was touch is our most universal and our most philosophical sense. Because for him, the very fact that we're exposed to others when we touch, that we're touchable, we're tangible, meant that we were encountering otherness, newness, strangeness, right? And we weren't closed up on ourselves, as the eye can enable us to do. I mean, it's precisely because touch makes us vulnerable to the other that we actually question who and what we are and who and what the world is.
And although we might be tempted to think we can talk it out, talk, 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 sometimes we just can't.
As anybody knows who has been through depression, and most of us have at some point in to some degree, you know, there's this... We can't read, we can't eat, we're not interested in anything. We feel this incredible disconnection and loneliness, but there's a huge touch hunger, you know, hunger to touch, to hug and be hugged by people. So whether it's, you know, touching the earth, touching animals, touching and being touched by loved ones, family and friends, it's so important to our psychic well-being.
Yeah, you had a very wise friend who said to you at a particular point in your recovery, enough talk, back to the body.
Yes, indeed.
Yep, so get out of the head sometimes. Yeah, you're not going to think your way through everything and just go with the body and trust that.
And in this highly digitized age, we need to remember our primal need to connect with human beings in the flesh.
And my argument is not against the virtual code. It's extraordinary. But that we need both, that we shouldn't lose the digital fingerprint as we move into the digital virtual world of technology. Because as one philosopher put it, technology overcomes distance, but it doesn't bring nearness. And there's a difference. Loneliness is one of the biggest symptoms of our current digital age, in fact, what I call the age of excarnation. Because in spite of and for all our hyper-connectivity, and that's wonderful, we can, as it were, be in touch with people and events all over the world, there's a profound inner loneliness, a lack of contact and what I call tact. And curiously, the experiments are showing that this sense of loneliness is even stronger with the millennials and the Generation Z, the current upcoming generation. But so many of contemporary films and TV series are picking up on this anxiety. You know, think of Westworld, that series, you know, where humans create cyborgs and they relate to them, but the cyborgs can't relate back to them. And so we can have dominion and mastery and manipulation, but it ultimately leads to tragedy. We're witnessing digital technology putting itself into question. Not saying we should get rid of it, but saying if we go with it, and we should go with it, and it's our future, we mustn't leave touch behind. We need both. And with the climate crisis and ecological crisis, this is the most important moral question. How do we get back in touch with our lived animal interspecies earthly being?
How's that for a question as you boil your egg? Philosopher Richard Kearney with Brendan on Sunday. Michael Dowling is an immigrant success story. He grew up in a thatched cottage in Limerick, and he's now a very big deal in the healthcare sector in New York.
And particularly as we speak this Wednesday morning, what are we on, the 17th of February, for whatever reason, this week, the last week, and maybe the next week or two, we find ourselves as a country quite jaded and a little fed up and just feeling that the 5 kilometre hamster wheel of repetition. And that's just for, that's one thing. Then you've got families who might be in a flat or an apartment, and they might have families with kids with who aren't well, and just the struggle. You know what I'm talking about. What do you say to people listening this morning who just can't quite get a handle on the hope, can't quite grasp the sense of optimism and see the cavalry coming?
I would say don't give up. Optimism is important. You go through tough times, you go through difficult times, as everybody is going through right now with COVID, but it will end. There is a brighter future ahead. There's a light at the end of the tunnel. So whenever you're down or you don't see the possibilities, I would say kind of sit back and put it in perspective a little bit. Don't play victim. Think of what it is you can possibly do if you have a positive attitude. It's a good world overall. There are good people. There are people trying to make a positive difference.
And he favoured taking the long view, almost a historical perspective on dealing with adversity and COVID.
You know, in New York, Michael, one of the most, and I go every time I visit that beautiful city, the famine memorial.
It is
such a striking piece between skyscrapers, this chunk of Ireland. It's extraordinary.
It's extraordinary. And also, and that's important perspective, because no matter how bad you think you're having it today, there have been worse times. People have gone through very difficult circumstances. So sometimes you look at your own circumstances and say, oh boy, look how bad this is. It could never get worse. Mm. And then if you know a little bit of history, you think of people back then in the coffin ships coming from Ireland, taking months to get here. So we think our situation right now is that difficult. Think of those situations. Yeah. Families locked in the hull of a boat, coming all the way across the United States, getting here and making a new life. So perspective is important.
Mm,
people get through these things.
Indeed.
And there is a better future at the end. So that's, I think, what people got to keep thinking all the time. And I know right now, especially with COVID and in Ireland, you can only travel, 5 kilometers from your house, and you have to wear a mask and you've sort of have a social distance. We do the same over here with regard to mask wearing and other things. And people say, oh, life is very, very terrible. This is a minor inconvenience compared to what other people have done over history. And a minor inconvenience in comparison to what other Irish people have done over history. So put it all in perspective. We are in many ways quite lucky, but we just have to have that common ongoing sense of positivity and optimism.
Michael Dowling with Ryan. However, when Associate Professor of Psychology at UCD and Principal Clinical Psychologist at St. Vincent's Hospital, Dr. Paul Dalton, spoke to Sarah and Cormac, he was not about to Pollyanna our collective mental state.
As a people, we have never been as bored, as frustrated, or as lonely since the pandemic began. So this is a 12-month high of loneliness, frustration and boredom. If we could take the psychological kind of temperature or pulse of the nation, I think it would say to us, we're spent.
Spent and bored. And not in an I'm bored way, no, something much more profound.
When I said that as a kid, what I got in response was, well, isn't it well for you? No? So we're not talking about that kind of boredom. We're talking about the kind of boredom, you know, the never been busier, but I've never been as bored. And I'm particularly conscious of parents who are homeschooling, who are taking care of elderly parents, double, triple jobbing. Or I see colleagues, Cormac, down the road in the hospital who are working under enormous pressure, but bored, you know? And so I think the bored person just doesn't have nothing to do. It's more complex.
It's not. And as if we needed it confirmed, we are not meant to be alone. Not like this, anyway.
We're not designed to live in bubbles. You know, we're social animals. Our inner circle is there. It's made up of our immediate families and friends. They form the kind of secure base where we can go out into the world and meet the others. And the others, so Cormac, this is the important piece. The others in our lives, the acquaintances, the people that my sister described this as, oh, that's like the people I meet in the staff room. She's a teacher. So those kind of people that, you know, we have those interactions with. And it's said, actually, that the average human being has about 150 people like that in their lives that go to make up their week. It's those people, actually, that really offer us nourishment and engagement and the kind of incidental conversations that are now taken away from us.
Oh, things we know all too well. But what to do about it while we wait for the bubble to expand or maybe even burst?
There's no quick fix, but there are three things that are really important. Widen the circle. So that inner circle of our close family and friends, about 10%, about 10 people, makes up about 60% of our social time. So extend the circle. This week, make contact with someone who's outside of your inner circle. Make an arrangement to meet them on the phone and go out and walk with them. Number one. Number two, watch our emotions. Our emotions are very strong at the moment. The irritation, the boredom, the loneliness. Now, I'm not encouraging for a moment that we repress emotions or push them down, but we have to keep them in their place, and we keep them in their place by drawing on our values. Okay, so we are in the final race, the final leg of this race. So we've got to remind ourselves, why am I doing this? And keep it really simple. I'm doing this in order to keep myself and other people alive. So in kind of calling on the value, in calling on those things, we balance up the emotions. We don't give the emotions. We allow them into the house, but we don't give them run of the house. And finally, carry something beautiful in your mind. The 17th century philosopher Pascal said that when we are in crisis and difficulty, carry something beautiful in your mind, an image, a word, a place that we can hold on to when things are really difficult. There's a man I saw this afternoon, a cancer patient. He's been 3 months in isolation. I said, what are you carrying in your mind? He said, my grandson.
Beautiful.
Dr. Paul Dalton on Drive Time. And Auschwitz survivor, psychologist and author of The Choice, Dr. Edith Eger, knows more than most about resilience and finding beauty in the darkest of places. She joined Ray on Thursday, and it's fair to say, having had a dance on Ray's TV show a while back, they're smitten.
Hello, my dancing partner.
Oh, you're so lovely. You're so lovely. That's a memory I will take with me to my grave, Edith.
Yes, I think that you were the most sensitive, beautiful interviewer, and
I don't know about that.
It's so wonderful to hear your voice.
Yes, and great to hear yours too.
Now, Edith is 93, and given everything that she's been through in her life, it's extraordinary that she's not more angry.
When people read your book, they get angry on your behalf. What do you do with your anger, Edith, your own anger?
Well, you know, I was guided by my precious God, Tinker Bell, the free spirit, who tells me I don't like it, it's inconvenient, and it's temporary, and I can survive it.
Okay.
So pay attention what you're paying attention to, and what you think is very important It truly is. When you get up in the morning and you look in the mirror and say, I love me. Love thy neighbor as thyself is very, very wonderful. Okay. That was said by a very poor Jewish boy called Jesus. Yeah.
And then, as you might expect, this text.
Can I ask what advice you could give us during the pandemic? I'm handling it well. I've lots to do, but I do miss my friends, lunches and nights out, etc. Sometimes I feel I'm getting used to this and won't know how to react when we're back to normal. Mm-hmm. What have you got to say to Anne?
There is a difference between reacting or responding. When you react, many times you don't think. And you have to really check out a movie called The Karate Kid because it tells you that the best power is brain power. Auschwitz was an opportunity to discover what my ballet master told me, that God built me in such a magnificent way that all my ecstasy has to come from inside out. And when I was in Auschwitz, that's when I began to know what that word meant. When he told me, I didn't know what ecstasy was. But now I know that nobody makes me happy. I make me happy.
Yeah.
And it's very, very good for you to look at this time to tell your wife, I'm ready to have a love affair and I want to have it with you. And see that there is no going back. There is a new beginning.
And the lovely Ray and Edith chat ended on this note.
When all of this is over, Edith, and we're out the other side and you're travelling again, let's hope we can dance one more time.
Oh, I would love that.
Thanks,
Thank
Edith.
Thank you, bye, Irish, bye, bye. Wonderful, loving, dancing people.
Back in a bit. Welcome back. On the rolling wave, a recording was unearthed of fiddler Michael Coleman.
He was kind of a superstar of his era in music, wasn't he?
You get that sense. And I don't believe in competition when it comes to music. I think of Béla Bartók's phrase that competitions are for horses. But if there were a competition for fiddle players, I think Michael Coleman is someone you wouldn't want to be competing with.
Aoife Ní Cormac with Liam O'Connor, director of the Irish Traditional Music Archive. And this is no ordinary recording. No, this recording was made in a kitchen in New York in 1942.
To find new, previously unheard recordings of Michael Coleman, it's a big deal, isn't it?
Oh, it's a huge deal, really. And I was reluctant to believe it was true, you know, that there was more recordings of Coleman out there that hadn't been circulated. In some instances, Coleman is playing solo, unaccompanied fiddle, which is, you can really hear the detail, and it's almost like the brush strokes of an artist. You can get a sense of what he was about. He was performing to a peer, and there were two fiddle players of exceptional standards. So I get the sense in these recordings that he wasn't going to let his own standards drop. It was different. There wasn't a piano accompanying him on some of the tracks. So I think these would be very, very insightful. You know, the opportunities to record were hampered by the Great Depression in the 1930s in New York, and then he died an untimely death in 1945 as well. So these are an insight into a period of fiddle playing that haven't been heard really. Thank you.
It's amazing to think of the circumstances of that recording from the Rolling Wave. Now, James McLean plays football for Stoke City and the Republic of Ireland, and the Derry native has refused to wear the poppy. And it is this decision which he believes has made him the source of racist abuse and threats for almost 10 years in England, where he lives now. This week, it reached a tipping point. On Wednesday, Erin McLean, James's wife, spoke to Claire and detailed the latest threat her family had received.
So this morning, it refers to the message about burning down the family home with us, with all of us on it. Someone messaged James's brother this morning and just said, rather than burning down the family home, they would rather tie James to a chair and set him on fire and tie me and the kids up and make us watch it. So that was just this morning when we got that one.
Erin, I know that you say you're used to hearing messages like that directed at James and directed at you, but you have three small children, and I know they range in age from 7 to 3.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you put up with that?
I don't know. I just think over the years, we have been getting it so constant that you do kind of just, you just get used to it somehow. But I do feel once the kids is involved, and it's personal like that, like, you're going to the effort of saying tying them up on chairs and setting people on fire. Like, that's the ones that kind of blow my mind to this day. And, the ones that really take me back, like they kind of take me back, definitely.
And she spoke about the fear and dread surrounding one particular threat.
There was that time when he was at Sunderland when there was the threat that somebody said they were going to bring a gun to the match. You had to sit through that match and watch it on television.
Yeah, so it was an away game down in London, and I got the threat the night before, and the police and stuff arrived to the hotel and stuff to check he was safe and that. But the next day, watching that match, I was up in Newcastle, that's where we were living at the time, and I remember just, sitting that whole match thinking kind of like, how am I going to get down to him if something happens? What do I do? Do you know that kind of? So it was horrific. Like, it was a horrific experience.
See, I'm listening to you, and I can only imagine the stress of having to live with that.
It was. Do you know what? It's like I said, we have kind of gotten used to it over the years.
But you shouldn't have to get used to it, Erin.
No, we shouldn't. Definitely not. But that's just how it's been, and that's kind of why we're speaking out now, because we don't want anyone else to ever have to go through what he's been through for a decade.
And Erin talked about the nasty comments the family gets from strangers in the street and how they have to manage even normal day-to-day things like getting post. And she wants social media platforms to bring in proper ID, like a passport or a driver's licence, for its users so they can be found and, if necessary, sanctioned if they make threats. But thus far, that has not been forthcoming. So, given that the abuse and threats have been a feature of their lives for almost a decade, how do you keep going?
I'm sure people are listening to this, Erin, and wondering, how you live your life with the worry of your husband going out to work to do his job, that something might happen to him, the worry about something arriving at the club, the worry about a threat coming to your home, the worry about your children going to school and someone saying something to them and their lives being changed because of that. Like, what kind of a toll does that stress take on you?
It is. It's definitely hard. But like I said, I do think a lot of the threats are just empty. I don't think, there's any real meaning towards it. I can handle things being sent to the club because it's not the house. You just kind of have to, me and James talk a lot about it. We just have to kind of sit down and make sure, things aren't getting too out of hand, and that we're both kind of, taking steps to ensure that the kids are held back from seeing the abuse and stuff. Mm-hmm. But it's definitely hard. It's just whenever the kids, it's them that we're trying to protect. You don't want anything to come to them and, upset them.
Erin McLean. And then at the end of her interview, this happened.
Well, we didn't expect to have James on with us, but James McLean was listening to all of that and is on the line now. Good morning, James.
Morning, how are you?
I'm good, thanks for joining us. Is it hard to hear your wife describe the toll that it's taking on your family, all of this?
It is, but like I see how she is on a daily basis. So, I see the effect it has on her day in, day out. So it's nothing new to me.
Maybe so, but Claire put this to him.
We're getting lots of messages in support, which I'm sure you'll appreciate. But we're also getting messages asking about the balaclava incident. And people are saying, does James think it was right for him to wear a balaclava in front of his children with a caption on social media saying teaching Irish history? Now, I know you've spoken about that before, but lots of people listening to that say, well, you inflamed the situation by doing that.
First and foremost, I'd say to those people, if you honestly are sane enough to think that I sat down with my children, 1715, and actually spoke to them about the Troubles and the Irish history, then, you know, I can't help them people, because that's just, as a father, that's just, I would never do that. At the time, it was supposed to be, you know, supposed to be funny. It was supposed to be a little jay back that, well, you betray me this way, well, here's two fingers up at you, really, without really thinking the consequences of what it might actually cause and the hurt.
Are you saying, James, it was a reaction to the abuse, that post?
Yeah, it was. Look, Claire, I'm portrayed as the person in the balaclava. I'm approval-loving this and I'm approval-loving that and, you know, this and that. And, yeah, look, it was an advice little jibe back at them. You know, it wasn't. It annoys me because now it's giving people kind of, in a sense, justification. They continue their abuse and they'll just post that picture and say, well, you know, you don't help yourself. But Claire, this picture was in June or July, like of just the year past this. This has gone on, like the level of abuse has gone on day in, day out for 9 years. Like, everybody's got a breaking point. I would say to those people, say, well, he brings it on himself. You put yourself in my shoes, right? You love my life day in, day out. You receive the messages I get day in, day out. At some point, right or wrong, you're going to react.
James and Aaron McLean with Claire on Wednesday. Now, we started off this week's playback with an homage of sorts to the 1980s. But not everything from that decade has aged well. The Hellraiser film franchise, for example, 1987, the very first one. It's still going. Hellraiser Judgment, the latest offering.
If something's still on the go, it'd want to be very good or very lucrative. What's the setup here? Do we need to know the setup, Tara?
Tara Brady with Sean, not sounding like a five-star groan.
Like a lot of horror franchises, as time goes along, like the assistant director gets to direct the next one. And for Hellraiser Judgment, the writer-director is in fact a makeup artist since Hellraiser 3. And he also plays one of the main roles in the film. And it's about as DIY as that sounds. But I will say this, it is absolutely revolting.
Pinhead is the ongoing, the central character here from the Cenobites sect. And the auditor, the director who you mentioned is playing here, Gary J. Tunnicliffe, of the Stygian Inquisition. The both of them are fretting that hell has been made obsolete by modern appetites for degradation. Put that in your pipe and smoke it. So, grotesque. Good thing or a bad thing, Tara?
Well, it's a very bad thing. you would say it's one for the fans, but it's really hard to know who it's for. It's one of those films that credits didn't come along for almost 20 minutes. So you're watching this like very long prologue. And I was just like sitting there peering into the gloom and going, did I miss a scene? Is something been lopped off here? I actually can't follow this apart from the fact that there's, you know, topless ladies, you know, drinking up secretions and things. And then you have this sort of focus group from hell, who knew those two things would go together, going along. Yeah. And then suddenly it turns into a police procedural with this kind of cheap knockoff of Seven investigation. And that's going on as well. And none of it really makes any sense.
She gave it a star. Just. Ryan was giving some gritty life lessons on Friday. Lessons, in fairness, no one asked for. Poor 12-year-old Jack ringing in thinking he was going to do the kids know stuff quiz, cutesy, and leave with some loot, a book, a board game, a sod of turf, an orange, you know, treats if it was the 50s. And in the course of chit-chat, it transpired Jack had himself a new brother, 1-year-old Ted.
One?
Yeah.
She's hardly a human at all. What's he just doing, sitting there getting his nappy changed every other minute?
Yeah.
Have you changed a nappy yet, Jack?
I haven't had the privilege.
Yeah, you haven't had the privilege. Do you know what? I think today is the day, Jack. Is your mum there?
Jack, appropriately nervous. Here's Mam.
Lorraine, today is the day.
Today is the day!
Now, what I want you to do is, as respectfully as possible, I want you to make sure that Jack changes Ted's nappy, but it can't be a number one.
Yes. and they're the ones he runs from.
Yeah, Jack is a young boy. He's a young man at this stage. He needs to know what it's like to be for in his future life. Hopefully, if he's fortunate enough to have kids or wife, whatever it might be. Doesn't matter. Could have a husband. Don't care a damn, but he could have a kid. And if he does, at the age of 12, he needs to be introduced to what you go through, Lorraine. Hour in, hour out, producing these filthy repositories of feces and urine.
Yes, in your Ted is well capable of that. So.
And you're right, he's well capable. Ted knows he's eating like a lord and he's dumping it in like a builder. And, you know, you're sitting there with his detritus in a nappy. And you know what, Jack, wake up and smell the story, because this is real life.
He's going to love you for this now. I love it.
Cackling, and the poor kid only came on to get a jigsaw. Well, that is it for this week's playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week, and we will finish where we started. Double dare ya not to sing along.
Slide feet up the street, bend your back, shift your arm, then you pull it back. Let's hard you know. Egyptian.